Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, good morning. It's all ducks and chooks today on Conversations. My first guest has travelled all over the world looking for specimens of the extremely rare Labrador duck. It's so rare, in fact, that it's extinct and has been for more than a century now. His name is Dr. Glenn Chilton, and Glenn Chilton's an ornithologist, a bird biologist who absolutely loves his job. Glenn Chilton went all over North America, the UK and France and Russia in search of every stuffed specimen of Labrador duck that he could find. And the great danger, of course, with this kind of quest is that you become a man obsessed, and he happily admits he is this. Glenn Chilton's book is called The Curse of the Labrador Duck. Glenn, good morning.
Good morning, Richard.
The Labrador duck, it's a fine bird, isn't it?
Well, it is a fine bird, or it was a fine bird. They're not making them anymore.
No. What does it look like? Describe it to me.
The male was a striking black and white. In fact, it was called the pied duck, the skunk duck, as well as the Labrador duck. The hens got kind of shortchanged in the looks department, gray, brown, trying to hide from predators while sitting on a nest, of course.
It's a black and white duck with quite unusual markings on it then.
Yes, a black ring around its neck, a black stripe across the top of its head, black wings, otherwise white.
It was obviously native to North America, Labrador being part of Canada. Where did it live and why did it become extinct?
Well, two very big questions. The first, where did they live? They bred somewhere in northern Canada. Maybe Labrador, maybe the Ungava Peninsula, who knows, maybe they tucked over to Greenland on occasion. And then they'd migrate down the seaboard and spend the winter around New York City and migrate up again to Labrador the next year to breed. Now, why they went extinct is a tricky question, because what we don't know about the Labrador duck greatly exceeds what we do know. Hunting, maybe, but they tasted awful and everyone knew they tasted awful. And so people didn't go out and hunt them. Maybe collecting their eggs on the breeding grounds. Yeah, but there's no record of that ever happening. I think the poor Labrador duck made the mistake of wintering around New York City. Late in the 19th century, the population was going up, all the waste from all those backsides going straight into the ocean, right where the Labrador duck was feeding. I think they got poisoned into extinction.
Oh, that's so sad.
It's terrible.
So Manhattan, that's the price we pay for Manhattan, the extinct Labrador duck.
The extinction of a poor, innocent species.
Where do the exhibits exist now? Where do they exist, these specimens of Labrador duck?
Yeah, now, of course, there aren't many. There's just over 50 specimens, and they're kind of scattered through the United States, Canada, and all over Europe, and one specimen in the Middle East. It seems as though when they were collected, they went to the museums that had the money, and for a lot of their history, that was Europe. And then New York City got into the act, and Washington, D.C. got into the act, and they managed to hoard a few. And the rest are scattered hither and yon.
Given that there's only, what, 50 over 50 specimens,
yeah.
How valuable are these specimens?
Well, that's even a trick by itself. It's worth whatever you could get somebody to pay you for it. Put a Labrador duck up on ebay.com.au and who knows? I am guessing somewhere between $50,000 and $100,000. Now, you
for
might
a stuffed duck?
Well, sure, but a painting can be worth much, much more than that. But still, $50,000 to $100,000 for a bit of skin and a bit of feathers, I think that's pretty good.
When did the Labrador duck first prick your interest as a kid, Glenn?
As a child. When I was growing up in Canada, my parents said, we're going to keep Glenn's English-British tradition alive. We're going to feed him tea until he vomits. And so we went through boxes and boxes of tea. And at the time, Red Rose Tea came with little cardboard rectangles with, Native North Americans or trees of North America. And one year it was wildlife in danger. And card number one that year was the Labrador duck. So that's the first time I ever heard about it.
But it wasn't in danger. It was extinct.
It was
by
long
then.
And the first four were extinct. And they came with such heavy messages, the finality of extinction, this kind of thing. Pretty heavy for a child already stoned on caffeine. But that's where the whole love affair started.
So it's up there with the top famous extinct birds, like the moa and the dodo.
The great auk, the passenger pigeon, birds we know a lot about. The Labrador duck we know very little about by comparison.
Because there are so few specimens of the duck.
And they just don't seem to have been written about while they were still alive. Naturalists were concentrating on, Carolina parakeets, because they were common and they were found in the southern United States. This poor Labrador duck up in northern Canada didn't get a lot of press.
So where did you make the decision to become an ornithologist then? Where did the love of birds begin? I'm assuming it predates this this card of the Labrador duck you pulled out of a tea tin.
I could have told you at 5 years old I wanted to be a bird biologist. I have loved birds that much for this long. Unfortunately, people kept telling me, that's not a job. You can't make a living as a bird biologist. There is no such thing. Work at a zoo. Work for a veterinarian. Well, it turns out that ornithologist is a profession and a pretty damn good one. I have a great life. I travel the world. Looking at birds, listening to birds, recording their songs, having fun.
You did a PhD on birdsong.
Yes.
What did you learn about birdsong in that PhD?
The PhD was really directed at questions about regional dialects in the songs of birds. Because pick a songbird species. Chances are, as you move from Melbourne to Brisbane to up where I am in Townsville, the song changes. All the birds in Melbourne will sing one song. All the birds in Sydney will sing another song. Up in Townsville, they'll sing a different song. And so I was curious about these dialects. And I chose a species called the white-crowned sparrow, the best-studied songbird in the world, and asked the question, do the females care? The males sing, do the females care what kind of dialect he sings? That was the focus of my PhD.
So, I mean, differences in language can, you know, range from the very mild, from different accents. You know, if we're talking about humans, different accents to different dialects to different full-blown languages. You're saying the difference in communication is in the dialect region. So they're speaking similar languages. It's not like, is it an accent or is it a full-blown dialect?
It's a dialect. It's a dialect such that the birds can notice the difference. You can hear that my voice is not Australian. My accent is not Australian. I speak a slightly different dialect. I have Canadian words that you wouldn't even recognize. Same with these birds. They would recognize that creature as a white-crowned sparrow, but know that it was not singing the local song type. And you and I can listen to it, and you and I can pick out the differences as well.
So will a Brisbane sparrow not then mate with a Melbourne sparrow because of the difference in language?
If it's close enough, the females won't care. If it gets too different, she'll always choose a local male over a male from further away. Isn't that just the greatest?
It's like footy teams in a way.
It is.
Supporting a footy team. So this brings us then to the Labrador duck. You've been following the story of the Labrador duck since you were a kid. What inspired the quest to track down every remaining specimen of them, Glenn?
I wish I could say it was something noble, Richard. I wrote an account of the white-crowned sparrow for a series in North America. It was about 24 pages long. And the publisher said, listen, if you write another account of any species you want, we'll give you the whole series for free. Free sounded pretty good to me. I said, well, I've written a long one about these sparrows. How about I write a short one? Sure, what would that be? How about the Labrador duck, a bird that went extinct almost before we realized it was around? And the stories that came out about some of these specimens as I wrote the account were so good. People, I think, to try and shut me up, said, you've got to write a book. You've got to stop telling me about these birds. Write a book. I said, I'll write a book, but I'm going to go around and around the world and examine and measure every specimen, bar none. So off I went.
So the first stop was Labrador itself. Now, this is the first thing I learned from your book.
Yes.
Labrador. You know, we in Australia, of course, we associate it with a breed of dog. Some people might know it's a province of Canada, yeah. Just off, you know, where Newfoundland is off the coast.
Upper right-hand corner.
Labrador translates from the French as Labrador, the golden arm.
But that's not where the name actually came from.
It's
Labrador
not.
Came from one of the fellows who claims to have explored that area. He was Portuguese, and he was a cultivator. And I guess in Portuguese, cultivator translates loosely as Labrador, and he would name everything Labrador that he encountered. So, yes, it does translate as arm of gold, but that's not the origin of it.
But there's a town there called Brador, isn't there?
Brador, absolutely. And some of these things are lost in the mists of time.
So you went there in high summer to Labrador. Tell me why. What the one single factor that ruins this as a place for holidaymakers in the height of summer going to the Labrador coast, Glenn?
The province of Newfoundland and Labrador is a wonderful place full of
yes.
wonderful people who
yes.
want to invite you into their home and get you drunk. But then in winter, you don't go there because of the wind and the snow and the icebergs. In summer, the place is just crawling with black flies waiting to take your blood. If you step out of your rental car, you're surrounded by a mass of black flies waiting to exsanguinate you. And
they bite.
Oh, they bite. They're kind of painless when they bite, and then you notice this trickle of blood running down your forehead. It can be a pretty tricky place.
So it's like the worst aspects of a fly and a mosquito, then, in other words.
Yeah, they're like a mosquito gone absolutely crazy.
Revolting. And that's where you headed off with your charming, and I can only assume, very patient wife.
A very patient wife, a very understanding wife.
What did she say when you said, darling, we're going off to find 50-something Labrador ducks all over the world? Was she up for that too?
Well, I try to be a good husband and an understanding husband, and in fact, I moved to Australia because my wife got a job at James Cook University. But she was supportive all the way through. She understands that I'm an obsessive personality. When I get something into my head, she realizes I can't stop, and so she pushed me on and pushed me on.
She's a wonderful person. So you went to Labrador to explore the nesting areas as they would have been there. You weren't able to find out much at all, though, once you got there, were you?
Well, there's the trick, Richard. I went there because John James Audubon, the great naturalist and painter, went there. He went there in 1833. And in the notes that accompanied his beautiful painting of the Labrador duck, he said, "We found nests on the hillside in Blanc-Sablon, now in Labrador." Actually, it's just across the border in Quebec now. And so I had to go, hot on his heels, trying to find the hillside where he found these Labrador duck nests.
But you wouldn't find anything there because they haven't been nesting for a century.
No, but I'm kind of obsessive. And I did find the low, tangled fir bushes that he described. But then I made the mistake of reading his journals, the actual journals that he kept when he was in Labrador. And the day that he claims, 10 years later, to have seen these nests, he explained that, no, we were in Blanc-Sablon, on a hillside, we're told they nest there, we did not find their nests. Oh, no. So the records that he kept on the day said he really didn't find nests there. My wife and I traveled all the way to Labrador to see the hillside where he did not discover Labrador duck nests. Sometimes too much reading is a bad thing.
I'm with Dr. Glenn Chilton, ornithologist and Labrador duck obsessive, and his book is called The Curse of the Labrador Duck, My Obsessive Quest to the Edge of Extinction. The next step for you was to track down the possible eggs, surviving eggs of the Labrador duck. And that took you on a very long detective trail that took you to Scotland, to Falkirk in Scotland.
Yes.
Tell me about arriving there and who had the eggs.
Uh-huh. Now, of course, one of the difficulties with eggs is they look like eggs. And there's no certainty that an egg is a Labrador duck egg, even if it has Labrador duck written on the side. So I had to go to these eggs, and there aren't very many, and take samples from them, subject them to DNA analysis, and determine whether or not they were Labrador duck eggs.
How do you take samples from them?
Ah, when you were a child at Easter time, did you blow out eggs so that you could paint them?
Yes.
Yeah, great. Poke a hole in either end and blow out the contents.
Yep.
This is what's done with museum eggs as well, so they don't rot and explode. So I went in through those tiny little pinprick holes with dental instruments, great magnifying lenses on my face to try and get the goop from the inside.
The goop that sticks inside the shell?
Well, sure, the membranes and whatever was left over after you blew it out. Subject that to DNA analysis, and then you can answer the question. Now, in Scotland, it was reported that a gentleman living in Falkirk, Scotland, had a collection of eggs and that he had what he thought was a Labrador duck egg. But then he got arrested by the police for having an illegal duck collection, claims to have smashed the lot. Now, you can just imagine me howling at the thought that in 1977 he had smashed
what he
might
raised.
Have been the only... Yeah, because he got arrested and he was upset about the whole thing. They can never come back and arrest him if he smashed the collection. The thought that he may have smashed the only Labrador duck egg in existence. But luckily, he was not only a thief, he was a liar. He had not smashed his collection. I got to go to Falkirk, go to this high-rise tenement where he had got a room, a bedroom, and then a room full of eggs, and take the material out from the inside of his egg, ship it off to a colleague at Boston University, and wait for the answer, is this a Labrador duck egg or not? Now, keep in mind, if it is, it's worth its weight in platinum. If it isn't, it's worth nothing at all.
And the result?
Oh, I hate to tell you, that egg was produced by a mallard, not a Labrador duck. And so this poor old gentleman, awaiting hip replacement surgery, waiting for the good news that he's got a Labrador duck. No, he's got a mallard egg, worth nothing at all.
Did you find any genuine Labrador duck eggs?
Not a single one. There were 6 eggs in the city of Dresden in Germany. And somehow they managed to survive the bombing of Dresden during the Second World War. They've been taken to safety, brought back. I went to Dresden again to take the goop from the inside. 6 eggs. Maybe these are Labrador duck eggs. No, they're red-breasted mergansers. At the end of the day, Richard, there are no Labrador duck eggs anywhere in the world.
Oh, that's so sad.
It is.
So then you started. You were hunting down Labrador ducks this whole time. This whole time, you went to Canada to the Royal Ontario Museum, and you went then to the United Kingdom, Smithsonian in the United States. You went all over the place. Once you found a specimen deep in the vaults of these natural history museums, what do you do with them?
What do you do with them? You make a very thorough examination. You measure them, you look at the bills, you look at the eyes, the glass eyes have been put in place. You take very meticulous measurements of the wings, look at where on the wing feathers, the tail feathers, in the hopes that this will tell you something about the ducks. When they molted, where and when they were migrating, where they stopped over, it's amazing what information you can get out of a stuffed duck. And of course, if they stay there, technology in the future may allow us to do even more than we can today.
Bring them back. With enough DNA material, perhaps. Were some of them a bit moth-eaten, a bit worn out?
Oh, some of them had been nibbled on by mice, by moths. Some are in great condition. You mentioned the Royal Ontario Museum. They keep theirs in a big safe, a big bank vault safe. Nothing can get in. Controlled humidity, no dust, no light. They survive very well. But other museums with smaller budgets would put them on the kind of shelving unit you have in your garage for your hammer and your power saw. No protection at all. They get dusty, they get ratty, they get attacked by moths, and over time, they become less and less pleasant to look at.
And then there's the glass eye. That's one thing of the taxidermist art that always disturbs me. When you were measuring the duck with your tape measure and your rulers and whatever, did you get that creeped out feeling that the duck was staring at you?
On occasion, looking at me reproachfully. I'm a vegetarian. No, I didn't shoot you. I had nothing to do with this. But of course, having seen all these Labrador ducks, I got to see the other treasures in the museums. I got to see a lot of extinct birds. The remains of elephant birds, stuffed great auk, stuffed Carolina parakeets. You know, you stick doctor in front of your names, doors open, you get to see great things.
Yeah, that's really apparent. You know, everyone else will get knocked back, but you're welcomed as an esteemed colleague when you go into these vaults, aren't you?
No matter how famous you are, Richard, if you walked in and said, I'd like to see your Labrador duck, they'd say, I'm sorry, it's not that kind of museum. They'd turn you away and send you off to the nearest pub.
So you're flying business class all the time when you go into these places.
Oh, I think I'm flying cattle class. Yeah.
War, as you say, has destroyed some other specimens of Labrador duck. That's very sad. And this wasn't just in Dresden, was it?
No, not just in Dresden. On both sides of the conflict, Liverpool lost a stuffed Labrador duck and many other prized treasures with the bombing of that port city. The German city of Mainzer was largely leveled by Allied bombing, and it lost a specimen and many great fossils and other great artifacts. That's a fact of war. People die, and world-class artifacts, great paintings, sometimes get destroyed.
Over time, over the years, you tracked them down. You went to Russia, as I said, to St. Petersburg.
You bet.
To all these different places all over the world, and saw all, I suppose, the official Labrador ducks. But if you're going to be a completist, Glenn, then you have to be alert to rumours, don't you, of other Labrador ducks that might be in private collections.
I'm so obsessed, I think I've got them all.
But you think you do?
I think I've got them all. But people were teasing me about this book. They said, you know what's going to happen. This book is going to be on the shelves for 10 minutes and someone's going to find another one. No, they won't. No, they won't. I found them all. They said, put your money where your mouth is. And so I'm offering $10,000 US, $11,000 Australian, something like that. If anyone can find me a legitimate, real, stuffed Labrador duck that I haven't seen, that I haven't written about in my book. They don't have to give me the duck. They just have to take me by the hand, say, there's a Labrador duck. I agree with it. I measure it. $10,000.
$10,000 US. It's out there, and you don't even have to hand over the duck. If you've got it, just give Glenn a ring.
You can keep it. You can give it to a museum. You can put it on auction. Whatever you like, just show it to me for $10,000.
And he will know if it's a fake as well. Did you encounter many fakes on this trail?
Not a lot. People have tried to fake me out with things as silly as carved ducks. They'll send me a photograph as an email attachment of a carved duck. Say, look, I've got a Labrador duck. No, you really don't. On occasion, museums that don't have a Labrador duck want one on display. We'll cobble together one from bits and pieces of other birds. So that's fine. It's an obvious replica. But I got to the city of Halberstadt in Germany, tiny little place you've probably never heard of and will never hear of ever again. They've got a modest collection of stuffed birds. They've had it for 200, 250 years. Great. All set aside in their vaults and their locked cabinets. And so they had a Labrador duck. And I went and they brought out their Labrador duck, the finest thing in their collection. They stuck it down in front of me and I put my face in my hands, and it's not a Labrador duck. It's a domestic duck. It's white. It's painted black to look like a Labrador duck. I had to tell them the finest specimen in their collection was a fake.
But they didn't want to hear that.
They didn't want to hear that. I was able to save the day a bit. I said, it's not entirely a fake. The bill is really that of a Labrador duck. At some point in the past, maybe 250 years ago, they had a stuffed Labrador duck. Moths ate it. Mice ate it. The only thing left was a bill. And so they went off to the local duck pond, shot a duck, painted it black in places, stuck on the bill. And I was the first one in all that time who came to the museum, the first person with the expertise to say, no, that's not a Labrador duck.
I'm with Dr. Glenn Chilton at the moment, the author of The Curse of the Labrador Duck, My Obsessive Quest to the Edge of Extinction. Glenn, as I mentioned, most of these ducks, of course, were in museum collections, but some were in private collections. The very final duck, this is duck number 55.
Yes.
The final duck in your book was really quite a fascinating little detective trail. And the eventual owner was rather fascinating too. Tell me how you got that rumour and tracked down that final Labrador duck.
Sometimes it was a matter of tracking rumours, tracking hearsay. And I heard about a duck that had been discovered in England in a country house in the late 1940s, offered for sale to the National Museum in England for £500. A lot of money, certainly. They turned it down, couldn't afford it. It went off to an insane millionaire who bought it for the £500. And there the trail goes cold. That's it. I heard that he'd moved to the Bahamas. I was in touch with the Canadian consulate in the Bahamas asking, can you find this man for me?
And what
this duck?
And what did they do for you once you contacted them?
They were good people. I guess that's why I paid Canadian taxes. They put an ad in the local newspaper saying, anyone who knows of Captain Vivian Hewitt, please contact Dr. Glenn Chilton in Canada. I got to work one day, and sure enough, the telephone was ringing. A gentleman explaining to me that the captain was dead. But he had left a couple of, he said, illegitimate sons, and I should try to contact them. Well, the only illegitimate son left is himself, insane, living in Wales. It took me year after year contacting families, contacting the auction house that had gotten rid of the insane millionaire's collection. On and on it goes, but I did finally track it down.
Yes, but when you spoke to a friend who was aware of it being auctioned, but they wouldn't reveal the identity of the person who bought it. Tell me how you picked away at that little bit of information.
I picked away like picking at a scab when you're a child. I can't let things go. My wife describes me as a dog with a bone. I just keep after things.
I said, we can't possibly disclose who this has been sold to.
We can't possibly do that, but you ask enough people, someone sooner or later will slip up and tell you it had been purchased by a sheikh in the Middle East. But of course, now he can't get it out of Britain because it's illegal to take out precious natural history artifacts. If they've been in the country for more than 50 years, they stay there. But he's got diplomatic immunity. He took the duck, stuffed it into a diplomatic bag, and took it off to Qatar. He got it to Qatar. Now, how am I going to get to see this? How am I going to get to examine this? He doesn't need me. He doesn't care that I'm writing a book.
So you have to go to the Qatari royal family, go knocking on the door and say, hello, Glenn Chilton here. I want to take a photo of your duck.
And they wouldn't.
No.
They wouldn't let me.
Did you contacted them?
I tried.
And
I tried
what response did you get?
I got none at all. Which is frequently the response you get when you ask silly things of people, important people. But then I got a telephone call late one afternoon saying, Glenn, the specimen is being brought back to Britain, probably in another diplomatic bag, to get a temporary export permit. It'll be in London at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. If you can fly to London, 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, you get to see that duck. After that, it's going back to Qatar. You will never see it again, at least not for the next 300 years. Got on the internet, booked a flight into London Heathrow, flew in, there's a cardboard box with my duck in it, and I did eventually get to examine and measure that duck.
That wasn't a bad duck either, was it?
It was a very handsome specimen.
A very handsome specimen. And it had been hand-painted here and there, though, hadn't
it? Yes, as many of the specimens are. I can do better than nature. I'm going to touch it up with a little bathroom paint here and there. But otherwise, it was in good shape.
And so this is almost a 10-year quest that's taken you all over the world to find these ducks and the eggs, sadly, of which none were authenticated. Once that final duck is photographed in London, is there a massive sense of anticlimax for you? And disappointment or what? What? Emptiness?
Completion, perhaps. I'd finally come to the end of the quest. Now, something like 12 men, I guess it is, 12 men have walked on the moon, but only one man has ever seen every Labrador duck. No one's going to try and do this again. So a sense of accomplishment. Now it's on to other projects.
Indeed. So what's next?
Well, I was asked, am I going to go after other extinct species?
Yes.
No, never again. That's just silliness. That's really obsession. So I've been looking at introduced species. something which all Australians are very familiar with. The terrible impacts of introduced species. I've been going around and around the world to exotic places like Ethiopia and Sri Lanka, and indeed Australia, looking at weird examples of introduced species.
You've moved from Canada recently to Australia, as
That's
you mentioned,
right.
the best of your wife. How are you coping with the change from the cold to the hot?
Oh, my goodness. I'm a good cold weather Canadian boy. And the hot weather of Townsville is just about melting me. I've come to love air conditioning.
A man with heat rash.
That's right. Heat rash. That's right.
It's great to meet you. It's fantastic to talk to you today, Glenn Chilton. Thank you so much.
And, my pleasure, Richard.
And congratulations on having tracked down every single last Labrador duck.
Let's hope it's every last one.
There you go. $10,000 US. And if you think you might have a Labrador duck in your position, how can people contact you? Via your website?
Via my website, glennchilton.com. Has all the instructions on how to claim the money.
Dr. Glenn Chilton, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Richard.
And Glenn Chilton is the author of The Curse of the Labrador Duck.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
And now from ducks to chooks. The chook is a marvellous thing. It's a social bird. It brings you eggs. It clucks. My next guest is Mark Tully. And Mark says these birds saved his life. Mark was working as a community development worker. He got burnt out in his job and he suffered a horrible anxiety attack that spiralled into a long and very deep depression. Mark locked himself in his cottage and refused to come out. But his birds needed him. And they found a way of getting him out. And Mark kept coming out until he realised he was, bit by bit, feeling better. Now Mark Tully travels across Australia in search of rare breed chickens. And that's because the 100% pure chook is becoming a rare breed and it's in danger of extinction. Mark was featured in the documentary Rare Chicken Rescue. And here's a bit from the doco where you can hear him talking to his turkeys.
Hello? What you doing? Really?
Fantastic. Mark Tully, good morning.
Good morning, Rich.
You said just before we went to air that having chooks in the backyard is good for you.
Well, it is. Being able to get outside and smell the fresh air, see a flutterby fly by, and then see your chooks having a scratch around in the grass. And you see, the wonderful thing about chooks, they're full of personality. Each breed has a different trait. They have different colours, different sizes, different shapes. And the wonderful thing about it is just having a couple of hens in your backyard also gives you eggs.
You said that most of us have forgotten how to test an egg. How do you test an egg?
If you go and get your eggs and you want to see how fresh they are, get a bowl of water and you place your egg in the bowl of water. Now, if it sits dead flat on the bottom, it is fresh. But if it lifts slightly, it's starting to get on the stale side. And if it's standing on its end, it is stale. And if it's right floating at the top, it's a politician weapon.
This week is Bring Back the Chook Week. Bring back what chook?
The whole thing is, according to the United Nations, the world loses 3 breeds of domestic livestock every month to extinction. Now, that's unacceptable, because once upon a time, domestic livestock breeds, especially the old ones, the human race depended upon them in some village of some civilization in some part of the world. But the more importantly thing is that over 63% of poultry breeds are on the verge of extinction.
Why?
Well, the big thing is lack of education. Most people don't know that amongst chooks and geese and ducks and other breeds of domestic livestock, they are different breeds. Chooks aren't just chooks. Ducks aren't just ducks and turkeys aren't just turkeys. Like, for instance, with chooks, there are different breeds of chook that lay different coloured eggs. There's meat chooks, there's laying chooks, there's ornamental chooks. But the importance is keeping their genetic material together. There is such a thing as climate change, that the earth is heating up, for whatever reason it is. But the United Nations realises that a lot of our commercial strains and commercial breeds are going to need other genetic material to help them make it through that. In fact, what we need is our commercial growers to seriously look at backing a domestic livestock museum, living museum, and that's what I'm trying to do.
So you want to take a long-term view on this?
Oh, absolutely. Take the silver grey Dorking, for instance. Now, it's 10,000 years old in recorded history. It was used as the primary protein source by the Roman legions, and it was spread throughout much of the world by the Roman legions. To talk to kids about different breeds, it's not just about animals. We can teach them about geography and history at the same time. Australia is so important because we're such a young country. When our immigrants came into Australia, prior to 1963 when we had a closure, a lot of the immigrants brought their plants and animals with them. And that made Australia so unique. So in parts of the world where these breeds originally came from, where they're either now totally extinct or they've lost their original type, there are still small pockets of them here in Australia.
It's Spain, isn't it?
Spanish chickens
that are extinct in Spain.
Extinct in all of Europe.
But here in Australia.
Yes, here in Australia there are some. Talk about multiculturalism. It's more than just people to come together. We've actually made an ark in more ways than one. But it was only just recently, as far as science goes, that they discovered that the humble mallard duck is totally immune to MH51 bird flu. Now, everyone thought bird flu killed all birds. It doesn't.
Not ducks.
Well,
not particular that duck. Right.
But they haven't done any research into the other breeds yet either. For the Dr. Seuss fans, there is a chook that lays green eggs. It's only the shell, but it lays green eggs. There's chooks that lay mahogany-coloured eggs. There's chooks that lay blue eggs. There's chooks that lay white eggs, pearl eggs, brown eggs, speckled eggs. And then you've got chooks in all sorts of colours. Some have got hairdos, some have got leaf combs, some have got single comb. And there are breeders right around Australia that need to be commended. If they're keeping that breed true, and you know they are, go and congratulate them.
I want to get to the source of your love and fascination and dedication to chooks now, Mark. Grew up always loving chooks, didn't you?
I did. I can remember playing with plasticine as a little tiny baby, a 2 and 3 year old in my own little world where I was some crusader saving animals here, there or everywhere. And then when every Saturday came around in Sydney, I would grab my pocket money and duck down to Paddy's Markets. And Mum and Dad would be getting the vegetables and things like that, and I would let go of the hand and disappear over to that particular corner of Paddy's Markets and grab some day-old chickens. And I would come back with them in a little box and say, "Yes, Mum, a man said they were pullets." But sure enough, nearly every single time, I got roosters. So in Glebe there in Sydney, I probably had the largest urban population of roosters.
Really popular with your neighbours then.
I had to do was box them up every afternoon and put them underneath the house until morning. See, a lot of people don't realise if you put a rooster in a box and he can't lift his head, he won't crow.
You learnt to read at a very early age, but it turned out you were punished for that, Mark. Tell me what happened there.
Yeah, when I was a very young child, even before I went to preschool, I was learning to read the little golden books and read reading books. Once I started entering the school system, where they had structured days and there was even the sleep time. And because I didn't want to go to sleep, I'd grab a book and sit in the corner. But that wasn't doing what I was told to do, and so I ended up being disciplined for it. And unfortunately...
What do you mean by disciplined?
Oh, you know, hit with the ruler at the time for not doing what you were told to do or get sent to the principal's office. And ended up developing aversion to reading or writing. And the fact that I suffer with ADD as well didn't help.
What do you think you associated reading with physical pain?
No. Discipline. That was
just
wrong.
Just discipline. It was wrong.
Yep. When my parents encouraged it, the school system told me that there was a time to do it and a time not to do it.
Mark, you had a breakdown at the age of 30. You were a community development worker at the time. What do you remember about how that happened?
Well, I was probably overcommitted to my work. I was a good workaholic. If there was something that needed to be done, it was probably me that would put my hand up or they'd ask me to do it. And because I had no family at home of my own, I was a single guy, so I was the one left to do it.
There was an anxiety attack that started.
Oh, what massive one. And it went to my brother, rang me up and said, "Oh, we're going to go to the pictures," because he was up from Sydney. Taking my mum along, we went in to the picture theatre. I was running a couple of minutes late. By the time I just started to settle into the movie, I started with this massive pain in my chest and shooting pains down my arms, and we all thought I was having a heart attack. And next minute I'm rushed off to the hospital and in there for a few days, and unfortunately my commitment to my work was still a bit much. I ended up sewing myself out to go back to work, but that was the wrong move to do.
Were you still anxious at the time and short of breath and all those things, Mark?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like anxiety is a horrible thing where it takes almost complete control of your life. It can hold in pretty hard at times. And then when I ended up leaving the workforce, depression really grabbed in.
Was it the first time you'd experienced major depression?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Had you been a reasonably happy-go-lucky guy until then?
Always out there. And because you've got something happening to you that you're not used to, you could almost blame yourself, or you don't know what to blame, you don't know what to do. It becomes all-consuming.
Different people have had different descriptions of depression. William Styron, the writer, famously wrote a book called The Darkness Visible.
Yep.
Churchill famously described it as his black dog, the companion that would walk alongside him. I don't know. How would you describe that experience of depression? A leaden weight or fear? How would you describe that?
You know how you once were and what life was to you before, and then for some reason you're in this black fog. Everything just doesn't seem to work the way it once was. People don't treat you the way that they once did. It's also full of fear. So a lot of the things I was feeling and thinking were actually taking over. You actually restrict yourself because you then start blaming yourself. Well, I did. And so I didn't want to be around other people.
Part of you is ashamed of yourself for being that way?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Did you find it hard to leave the house?
I would prefer to stay in the place rather than associate with people. And that's probably where my turkeys came in, because whenever they were hungry and thirsty, they would get up on the tin roof and make so much damn noise, and it doesn't matter how much depression you got. And there's only so many pillows you can put over your head. You've got to go out there to stop them on the tin roof, so you go out and feed and water them, but you'd find yourself out there then.
Sounds like kids, Mark. You know, kids, they can often sometimes chase away depression because they don't know you're depressed. They don't really, they have their needs.
Yep.
They're not really interested in the fact that you're tired or depressed or anything. And same with these birds.
Absolutely.
So why is that healing for you and not incredibly annoying, dealing with that on top of depression?
To feel needed helps. To feel self-worth helps. To know that you're making a difference. Now, even if that difference is just making a puppy happy or a chook happy or a goose happy, and like, it sounds funny, but one of my best mates is a pig. He's a large black pig or Devon. Not many of them left in the world. He's about 450 kilos, and he tests me all the time, but he's always comes up and greets me and wants his scratch on his snout.
How does he test you?
Oh, you know, he'll break down the occasional electric fence and and things like that. But you can only laugh, you know, and like occasionally he'll give you a push, and then you just hope that it's not into one of his wallows or something like that.
Rare chicken breeder Mark Tully is my guest. So bit by bit you were getting up. Day by day you're getting up to feed the turkeys, feed the chooks, feed the animals.
Yep.
And you noticed you were feeling better, a little better.
A little bit. My biggest thing was to find purpose back in my life. And when I started realising that a lot of the breeds I remember even as a child were disappearing at a rapid rate, then I suppose I got my warrior spirit back. Wildlife, if we give them habitat and leave them alone, they'll pretty much look after themselves. But our domestic livestock are 100% dependent upon the human race. They are our living history. They deserve to be in our future too. If people in towns and cities right across Australia decided today I'm going to go and put some true breed hens in my backyard. They are being frontline conservationists like no other.
Why?
Because they're preserving a gene pool. By having purebred hens, it means there's a breeder out there somewhere that has to breed more. And by having purebred hens in their backyard, they are supporting a breed that's disappearing. They'll find that they'll be happier. They'll find they'll actually have true fresh eggs.
Fresh eggs that don't need to be grown in a farm outside of town, that don't need to be brought in and truck into the city to be bought from them.
We're saving carbon credits.
So, Mark, in this crusade, I think it's interesting too. You sort of found yourself a little helpless when you were depressed. You couldn't rally in defence of yourself, if you like, but you could for these birds you love. You found you could. You said you recovered your warrior spirit.
Yep.
Humans are funny creatures, aren't they? Humans.
We are. We are. We're also resilient if we're given a purpose.
We're resilient if we're given a purpose.
Yeah. And quite often we need to find that purpose in our life, whether it be our kids, our family, ourselves. And, like, to find a purpose in myself or for someone with depression or even someone suffering any ailment, to give themselves a purpose, a right, you know. What a lot of people don't recognise that each one of us are worthwhile people deserving of self-pride. We don't give ourselves enough love. We don't give ourselves permission to love ourselves. I'm not being silly that way, but just to appreciate ourselves. And, like, if you don't think you can do anything, just walk outside and watch a breeze move a tree. Feel the breeze across your face. Discover life again. It is worth it.
You say it's all about finding that purpose.
Yep.
Do you consider yourself lucky that your purpose jumped on your roof and started banging on it?
Absolutely. Well, you can call me Mark Tully, domestic livestock crusader. Well, guess what? There were some great crusades around the world in history. We just need a hell of a lot more people to join the army.
Now, you have to travel all over the countryside,
yep.
All over the countryside. You're kind of like a chook detective now. Tell me what you do.
I hear rumours.
Rumours about what?
Oh, that there's a bird like this or like that or, you know, that bird you were describing or whatever, or thought we saw something like that down there. And sometimes I just can't contain myself. I've got to go and see it.
What does that mean?
I don't have to have it, but just to know that they're safe is great.
And what does that mean for you then? You've got to get in a car and drive long distances.
Yep.
And you go to this farm where you've heard the these rumours are emanating from.
Yep.
What do you then say?
Hi, I'm Mark. You might think I'm a bit of a nut, but can I have a look at your chooks? A friend of mine actually said, so you go on adventures all the time, and he said, oh, you're a bit like Indiana Jones. I said, no. I've had way more fun than Indiana Jones. Because, like, you drive through a town, you're going through a storm, you get a flat tyre or something like that. There's always something happening. And even at home, Annie Oakley, who is a goat at my place, only this morning, I was feeding out at 4 o'clock this morning so I could get here on time. And some of the little Tamworth pigs came running up to eat some of the grain. Now, she headbutted them, and so they went running off, but they went and got Mum. Right? So Big Mum comes along, and here's this big 300-kilo Tamworth pig headbutting a goat, and they're fighting over this. But while Mum and the goat are fighting, the babies are in eating the corn. So a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
Have there been occasions where you've knocked on someone's door and said, hello, my name is Mark. I'm interested in your chickens and it hasn't gone well?
Oh, yes. In fact, once I didn't even knock on a door. I was Danny Tari, driving along the coast road there, and I saw this massive goose in amongst these other geese, a big white one, so it would have been a lovely white Emden. Like, it was just massive. I couldn't pull up there, so I had to drive right down, and there was a bit of divided highway, so I had to drive, I think, nearly another 60 k's to turn around to come back. And then when I finally got back, I just pulled up on the side of the road, just overlooking the paddock and just enjoying the view of this goose. And to put the story in perspective, there's my truck, right, which is a ute with cages on the back. And I'm sort of standing up beside it, just enjoying. And I actually took my camera out and started taking a couple of photos. I think it was my camera phone, actually. And the next minute, whack, across the back of the head, this old lady with a broomstick saying, "Don't touch my geese." And that.
So, "Don't touch my geese."
Yeah. She thought I was actually going to take him in that. And then I started talking with her sort of thing while running around my vehicle and said, "No, I'm just enjoying them." And she goes, "I've had them for 50-something years. No one's going to touch them now."
Did you get her to come round?
No,
you just had to get out of there.
No, but I've sent other people there and they've received the same outcome.
Well, this brings me to my next point, Mark. You're not alone. You're not the only poultry fancier in the country. You're in contact with these people and you've made enduring friendships.
Yeah. Judy is a wonderful lady and she's keeping some great breeds and she's in southern New South Wales. Dr. Harry Cooper is a great mate. And then there's people within poultry clubs. But there are some traditionalists in there as well that will keep the breed totally pure. Now, some of these people have been keeping birds for 70 years and yet council comes along and says, "Oh, no, they're just chooks." Well, they're not just chooks to me. The old timer is a national treasure with the knowledge that he has.
Well, this is it. Things are changing, aren't they, Mark?
Yeah, they are.
Councils are becoming more aware of the whole idea of permaculture. You keep chickens, and it's the chicken droppings that fertilise the soil, and they give you the eggs. It does make a lot of sense. Although you're trying to hark back to the culture of our grandparents, which may seem like a kind of a dying lifestyle, that lifestyle is starting to come back again.
Oh, it absolutely is. There's a great movement called the Slow Foods Movement, and that is about eating original foods grown the original ways. Like commercial tomatoes these days are designed so they can drop them from a meter and they don't bruise. Where the old Hungarian ox hearts or the old black zebra tomatoes, a lot of people wouldn't know what a real tomato tasted like.
I don't think I do.
Oh, the flavour is just incredible. And you see, even talking about our commercial eating chooks, like a lot of people don't realise that your roast from the supermarket chicken, a lot of them aren't even 10 weeks old from hatch. In fact, some of them aren't even 5 weeks old from hatch because they're designed to grow very fast. And before anyone says, yeah, the hormones they put them, let's get it straight. Hormones haven't been used in poultry for nearly 15, 20 years. It's actually illegal to use hormones in poultry. But the birds are designed to grow big. I eat my own roosters at home because I believe we've got to use them, or otherwise we lose them. To compare the flavour of a 12-month-old naturally grown bird to that of a six-week-old bird. Now, if you buy a straight frozen six-week-old bird, not butter-filled or anything like that, and don't put any herbs on it, just cook it straight and then cook a 12-month-old bird straight, the 12-month-old bird will have a lot more flavour, original flavour. And like the pigs, the old breeds of pig, like your large black, your Tamworth, your Berkshire, and the poor old Wessex saddleback. There's a pig that a lot of the old farmers and people would have heard of. But unfortunately, there's only 100 sows left on planet Earth. And most of them are here in Australia. Yet another reason why to love Australia even more. But they have the intermuscular fat. And once science used to tell us, oh, fatty meats is no good for us. But now they're saying, oh, but the intermuscular fat melts away when you cook it, so it is good for you. But it also leaves the flavour there. Like, chefs around the world would kill for meat like that. In fact, the price is already suggesting it. But more importantly, we need to be preserving our gene pools. And Australia is in the perfect position to set up a domestic livestock museum. And we need to do it not just for our own sake, but for the world's sake.
Just finally, Mark, you say the chooks have saved your life, essentially. They have. How are you managing depression these days? Does it still come back every once in a while? Can you manage it okay?
I've got to watch things. It's about management. through talking with doctors, medication. Depression can be managed. And unless we start talking about it and destigmatizing it, the big thing is, oh, they've got depression, I might catch it. You can't. It could affect anyone.
For a long time, you really weren't sure about human beings.
Oh, no.
How do you feel about people these days, in general?
Well, if you'd asked me 5 years ago, exterminate the lot.
No, you're not serious,
though. I am. I didn't think that the human race was worth anything. But if you ask me today, I see potential. Potential in the human race, there is potential to make a difference. And like, there's one person out there that can make a real difference, and it's someone listening. You don't need to form government to make a difference. The difference starts with one. The power of one is true. I suppose you can say, I've been through a bit of a dream time. Mark had to get lost before he found himself again. And many people are going through that. And we just need to encourage them. If they believe in something, run with it. And like, we've got politicians out there trying to save the country in this credit crunch, which worries a lot of people. But money can come and go. But our domestic lifestyle, which is our living history, and I'll refer to it again, once they're gone, they're gone. They can't be brought back. So, Mr. Rudd, as Prime Minister, you need a domestic livestock museum.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
And that was my conversation with rare chicken breeder Mark Tully. And if you're interested in finding out more about his fight to save endangered domestic livestock, he's now started a group called Domestic Livestock Crusaders, www.livestockcrusaders.com.au.
On ABC Local Radio. Conversations with Richard Feidler.